Welcome to the Environment Show, exploring issues and events of the planet. I'm Thomas Lally. The Environment Show is a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby from Bennington, Vermont. 1-800-C-A-R-H-E-R-E. Your host is former Environmental Conservation Commissioner for the state of New York and former president of the National Audubon Society, Peter Burley.
Thanks, Thomas. Coming up on this week's Environment Show, we'll get an update on what happened to the monarch butterflies in Mexico. This winter, 30% of the entire species died there, and scientists now think they know why. Then we'll look into the persistent problem of PCBs, the toxic set of chemicals that are everywhere. In our case study, river cleanup is still not ready to begin after 20 years of effort. We'll visit a community-supported farm where the grower becomes a partner with the people who buy his food, and find out in our Earth calendar what happens to insects in the winter. These stories and more coming up this week on The Environment Show. Earlier this year, about 30% of all monarch butterflies died when a rare snowstorm hit their wintering grounds in Mexico. At first, nature appeared to be the culprit behind the die-off. But human activity, especially logging, may have played a greater role than the cold weather. Lincoln Brower is a researcher with the University of Florida and the Wildlife Conservation Society. He brings us up to date on the situation.
On December 31st of this past year, there occurred a major snowstorm through these mountain areas. Now, if the forest is intact and left alone and protected as if it were in a national park, then there would be no holes in the blanket and the butterflies would be perfectly protected. But the problem is that the Mexican resources in that area are limited, and you have the perennial problem of rapidly increasing human population growth conflicting with the limited resources. And the forest resources are one of the few that these poor people have to live on. Our concern is that the deforestation in the area, which is going on legally and illegally because some of these areas are supposedly protected, will gradually deteriorate the forest blanket to the point where it can no longer support the butterflies. And the colonies are enormous. They're up to 7, 8, 9, 10 acres in extent. And we calculated that when the butterflies arrive, they cluster on these beautiful fir trees up at the high altitude. And in a colony that's 5 acres in extent, we're talking about maybe 10 million butterflies, just in huge, dense colonies. And during the course of the winter, the butterflies are quiet inside these colonies, but on sunny, warm days, millions of them will fly around against the blue sky, and it's like walking into Chartres Cathedral and looking up at the stained glass windows to see these beautiful butterflies flying against the sky.
Lincoln Brower is a researcher with the University of Florida and the Wildlife Conservation Society. Before World War II, American industry found that a group of man-made chemicals known as polychlorinated biphenyls, or PCBs, had very special qualities. They did not conduct electricity and are so stable that they did not break down in the environment. PCBs were used in electrical equipment throughout the land. 20 years ago, just about every transformer, from those that hung on light poles outside houses to those in big locomotives, was filled with oil mixed with PCBs. Then, long after they had been in use, PCBs were found to be poisonous. We learned the hard way. A barrel had been mixed with rice oil in a village in Japan, and the whole town became very sick. 20 years ago, the state of New York took action against the General Electric Corporation to prevent them from discharging PCBs from their manufacturing plants. But by then, PCBs were widespread, and today all of us carry some trace of PCBs in our bodies. In 1977, a settlement was reached whereby GE stopped using PCBs, and shortly thereafter the use of PCBs was banned altogether. Research on the health risks of PCBs has continued. Dr. Lynn Goldman, Assistant Administrator for Toxic Substances of the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, says children are particularly at risk.
A child who has high exposures to PCBs will not have the same normal development as a child who is not exposed. That child may have learning disabilities. The child may have hyperactivity, problems with concentrating in school. There are also, at even higher levels, effects from prenatal exposures, birth defects that can occur. But those occur at very high levels and really at levels that we would not expect to see from environmental contamination. Well, what happens is that the PCBs can accumulate in our bodies, and they are passed from one generation to the other. They are passed to the child in utero, even before birth. They are present in breast milk, and they are present in many of the foods in our diets.
In the Northeast, two great rivers, the Hudson in New York and the Housatonic, which flows through Massachusetts and Connecticut, were contaminated with tons of PCBs that were discharged by manufacturing plants to the General Electric Corporation. Eating fish from both rivers has been banned for almost two decades to protect human health. Experts say it will be generations before the rivers are fishable again. While action has been taken to stop PCBs in the ground from leaking into the water, a program to clean up the Housatonic itself has still not been finished. Al Weinberg, regional engineer for waste site cleanup of the Massachusetts Department of Environmental Protection, says after almost 20 years, a cleanup plan is still a couple of years away.
Well, the efforts up to now have been concentrated primarily in controlling the PCB sources and preventing further PCBs from getting into the river, as well as preventing any further migration of PCBs downstream.
A major player in the cleanup process is General Electric, who will wind up footing some of the bill. We asked GE spokesman for environmental programs in Pittsfield, Massachusetts, Steve Moore, why cleanup of the Housatonic after 20 years was still not underway.
That's a criticism that we hear a lot, and it really is a function of how the process works, where it calls for investigations to take place in a certain prescribed manner. You respond to that. Those results are analyzed, and then there are negotiations on how to proceed from that. It just is a very lengthy process. I don't know how else to explain it.
While the studies go on, private property owners with homes and businesses on the banks of the Housatonic find contamination of their property has reduced its value and made it extremely hard to get finances or mortgages. Attorney Cristobal Bonifaz, who represents a group of property owners seeking to recover for damages from PCB contamination, says that failures of government agencies has forced his clients into court.
They decided to sue General Electric as for themselves and on behalf of all the other property owners that at that time the properties had not even been tested. They call it a class action lawsuit against General Electric. Well, and this is when General Electric was not very happy about this lawsuit. I mean, fundamentally what has been happening since 1980 as a result of all these oil leaks and plumes and every other contamination that General Electric has carried out, there is a lot of dilly-dallying between DEP, EPA, and General Electric. There's tons and tons of studies as to where the contamination is, how the contamination got there, but nobody does anything about cleaning it up.
In addition to private litigation, the Attorney General for Massachusetts, Scott Harshberger, says that he too is contemplating a lawsuit to recover damage to public property. He describes what the PCB situation says about alleged trade-offs between the environment and economic growth.
It's a classic example of why concern for the environment has a direct correlation to individual property values and economic development. It is a, if you will, the paradigm case of why we cannot afford not to be concerned about good environmental protection and be concerned about economic development. They are not incompatible, and this is a classic example that shows what happens if we don't care about the environment. It will have an economic impact beyond our wildest expectations.
While the lawsuits proliferate and the studies grind on, a final plan to clean up the Housatonic is at best a couple of years away, suggesting that the only thing as long-lived as PCBs in the environment is the process by which plans are made to get rid of them. I'm Peter Burley. And now it's time for Locking Horns, an Environment Show debate. Getting rid of PCBs is a huge problem. If they're collected and stored on land, it's expensive to keep them so they won't escape into the environment. If they're incinerated, they can create dioxin, another poison. Currently, the U.S. EPA approves incineration of PCBs in licensed high-temperature facilities, but incineration is very controversial. Joining us are Dr. Anthony Mascotti, Technical Director of the Association of Responsible Thermal Treatment, an industry trade group, and Professor Barry Commoner, Director of the Center for the Biology of Natural Systems at Queens College of the City University of New York, locking horns over the question, is incineration an appropriate way to dispose of PCBs? Dr. Mascotti.
Well, I do respect the opinions that are held by others on this, but I think as we look at the history of PCB incineration in the U.S., we'd have to conclude that with over a billion pounds incinerated at this point in specially designed facilities, it's hard to argue that it's not an appropriate and cost-effective method for accomplishing that. The incineration process itself is held to certain standards. It's an extremely thoroughgoing technology and one that has accomplished a lot in helping rid this country of what might have otherwise been a lot of contaminating feedstocks of PCBs.
Professor Commoner.
It makes no sense to burn PCBs. Although the incinerator might destroy 99% or more, it will at the same time produce dioxin, a far more toxic pollutant. The amount of dioxin already produced by trash burning and other incinerators exposes the general U.S. population to levels that, according to EPA, create a cancer risk hundreds of times greater than the so-called acceptable one. Burning PCB will only add to this already serious situation. The only existing environmentally safe way to deal with it, to deal with the contaminated sediment, I think, is to seal it into concrete bunkers. That will cost a lot of money, but that's a price that GE ought to be forced to pay.
Dr. Mascotti, in reply.
Dioxin formation is something that needs to be better controlled, but I noticed Dr. Commoner suggested sealing the materials in concrete bunkers. I'd say we can at least agree that incineration and hazardous waste incinerators is better than the form that's being practiced now, which is incineration of hazardous waste in cement kilns. And to the extent that cement kilns ultimately are becoming the repository of such waste, that is to be regretted, and I think we'll be talking about more than just a few stray atoms of dioxin if that's allowed to become the case.
Professor Commoner, the last word.
Oh, I don't think any of that stuff ought to be incinerated. What I'm saying is the PCB ought to be locked away from the environment. It will be very expensive. It's the sort of thing that we're forced to do with radioactive waste from nuclear weapons. That's the point. GE got into this trouble, and they're going to have to buy their way out of it.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I'm Peter Burley. We really appreciate all the email you've been sending us. We're always interested in what you have to say. So write us at 318 Central Avenue, Albany, New York, 12206, or contact us by email at envshow@aol.com. That's envshow@aol.com. or reach us on the World Wide Web at www.wamc.org/env. That's www.wamc.org/env. You can hear The Environment Show anytime via the Internet. Just go to our webpage, download the Real Audio software, and then click on Listen to The Environment Show. Still ahead, we visit a community-supported farm where the grower works in partnership with the people who buy his food. And in our Earth calendar, find out what insects are doing in the winter. These stories still ahead on The Environment Show. Today, farming is so productive, most people don't have to think about how food gets to their table. Food is cheap and plentiful. And as a result, many family farms continue to go out of business. The producers which replace them usually rely on chemicals to grow crops for markets, sometimes thousands of miles away. But alternatives to the agribusiness model of farming have taken hold. Thomas Lally reports on community-supported agriculture, which has seen tremendous growth in the past decade.
Although they live in Manhattan, John Russo's family feels like part of them lives on a farm. They're part of a growing movement called Community-Supported Agriculture, or CSA, where people pay farmers ahead of time for a share of the harvest and in return get a load of fresh vegetables each week.
We have a single share, and we're three in our family, and it's more than enough. We give, actually, our food away to the older people in our building. It's so much. We're talking 8 to 12 pounds a week of food. It's like a good deal, and that's just the bonus. It's like the topping of the cake. The main thing is to sustain CSAs.
The Russo family are members of the Roxbury Biodynamic Farm, about 150 miles north of Manhattan in Claverack, New York. A few times every year, they make the trek up to the farm to meet fellow members and help out. The Russos are part of the CSA movement, which started in 1985 by several people, including Robin Van Am, now director of Community-Supported Agriculture of North America. Growing from one farm in 1985, today there are an estimated 600 CSAs involving upwards of 100,000 people. Van An says CSAs offer many benefits to both grower and consumer. One is that it eliminates the middleman, making small-scale farming profitable.
Advantages of CSA and the advantages to a farmer is actually having a relationship with the people that they're growing the food for, and also being able to grow a really diverse crop that really maintains biodiversity, and basically with this connection with the membership, it really allows the farmer to do the best job they possibly can by way of the land, the membership, and themselves. And it really sort of eliminates some of the economic burdens and just economic pressures that will push farmers to do things that they really know are really not proper land stewardship, but is sort of what's going to pay the rent for the time being.
CSA also represents a way to sustain farms which might otherwise be forced out of business by larger, more efficient farms. Verna Kragness is from Philadelphia Community Farm in Osceola, Wisconsin. She says many farms in the Midwest are in danger of going under, and CSA is one way to keep them in business.
It's the fact that in Wisconsin there are still two farms a day going out of business. And I think it's quite an interesting phenomenon that we have been able to create in just 6 or 7 years about 50 new farms on this model. We've needed for a long time a new archetype of a farm in the Midwest that many people can remember. I grew up on a 160-acre organic farm, which by the time I went through college was a 2,000-acre agribusiness. And so it's really not so long ago that there was a different picture of farming on the landscape.
For many, CSA is one good idea amongst many options in agriculture. It won't work for everyone. Today, CSA has had most success attracting white, educated, and middle-class customers. And although each CSA is different, they all take a degree of effort from the customer. But that's essentially the point. growers share the responsibility, along with the benefits of the farm, with their members. Jennifer Wilkins is a nutritional researcher at Cornell University. Although most CSA farms cater to families, Wilkins sees broader applications. She wants to spread the CSA model to institutions like hospitals and schools.
I think the important thing to keep in mind is the sustainability of the whole system, because if you focus on just one aspect, say for example organic production, then that could lead to, without considering the whole spectrum, producing an organic melon, for example, slicing it up, putting it on a styrofoam tray, shrink wrapping it in plastic, and then shipping it to New Zealand, and it's still organic, but it has a lot of environmental costs in that one product by the time it gets to a supermarket shelf.
The CSA movement is now at a crossroads. Many feel that if the meteoric growth of the past decade is to continue, CSA will have to reach out beyond its current consumer base. Groups like Community Supported Agriculture of North America, which works as the Association for CSA Farms, are currently working on ways to facilitate future growth, a tall task considering agriculture of any kind is risky. But CSA has found its niche in people like John Russo and his family. While there are 600 CSA farms today, Robin Van An says that number may rise to 10,000 by the end of the decade. The challenge is to manage the growth, something many farmers don't have to worry about. For the Environment Show, I'm Thomas Lally.
And now it's time for the Earth Calendar. If you live in a cold climate, you know how hard it is to stay warm at this time of year. But what about bugs? According to entomologist Tom Turpin of Purdue University, insects have to cope with cold weather just like everybody else. He says they do one of three things. They die, they hibernate, or they migrate.
One is that they just sort of don't survive. They die. The temperature freezes them, and they are no longer in that particular area. Some are adapted to survive these winters, and they do it basically by changing their physiology. One which we're more common with, or at least more commonly familiar with, is what is called hibernation. We're familiar with some of the mammals that actually do that, bears, the woodchucks, certainly what are known as the groundhogs are well known to come out of hibernation on Groundhog Day. Insects do that. They sort of slow down, crawl into a protected environment, and wait for it to warm up.
One insect many associate with winter is what's commonly known as the snow flea. These insects actually thrive as the temperature goes down. But despite their ability to propagate during the winter season, Turpin says their common name is ill-fitted.
The group of insects we know as Columbella are what most scientists would call sort of very primitive wingless insects. They, in the springtime, on a very, say, warm spring day when the snow begins to melt, they are sort of enticed to come out of their, should we say, their humus type of habitats down below the snow cover, and then are found on the surface of the snow in the pools of the water and things from the melting snow. And because the Columbella do have a jumping habit, which is very similar to that of the fleas, at least in terms of being able to jump from one place to the other, people sort of mistakenly then referred to them as fleas, and because they showed up during the periods of the melting snow, they put that together and they gave them the name snow flea, although they are not a flea, technically, according to scientific definition.
While the snow fleas are careful to keep themselves below the frost line, other insects spend their winters, like us, indoors.
The group of insects we know as the ladybugs are hibernators, and they tend to crawl off into some protected place and sort of snuggle down for the winter. One of the protected places that they sometimes get into, we call an attic in our home, and they'll come up the outside of a house, get into the attic, and find a place to hibernate. Now, this is fine until the sun starts beating down on the roof in the winter months, and that warms the insect up, and it starts crawling around, and it finds its way down into our living rooms and our kitchens, and then crawls around on our windows and on our cupboards, and causes some people to get concerned because they don't know what a ladybug is doing. Literally, it's trying to find its way out. It wouldn't want to get out because the winter is temperatures would kill it. But because the temperatures in the attic have warmed up, then it starts looking for a way out, and that brings it down into the living quarters of our homes, much to the concern of some of the human inhabitants.
Winter is tough on all species. But if you discover a ladybug in your kitchen on a winter day, it means something hot is going on in your attic. Thanks for being with us on this week's Environment Show. I'm Peter Burling. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 319. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, which is solely responsible for its content. Thomas Lally is the producer. Dr. Alan Chartok is the executive producer. The Environment Show is made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby. 1-800-CAR-HERE. So long, and join us next week for the Environment Show.